I'm doing something I've never done before on this podcast, and that is to share something I put out into the world that originated on TikTok. I felt compelled in this case to weigh in on the simple trending question. If you were alone in the woods, would you rather encounter a man or a bear? This may sound like a simple question on its surface, but really it's so much more complex than most people weighing in on the subject are really prepared for. This question asks you which is more dangerous. It also implies there could be a fate worse than being mauled or killed by a bear. And saying man versus human also raises some questions. As of early May, almost 8,000 women have weighed in on this conversation and their personal takes. Many posts have seen more than 2 million views. My personal post shared on May 5th on my profile at Corina Belizzi has been viewed over 90,000 times. There are some in my family who haven't wanted me to speak out for obvious reasons, but I simply couldn't hold back any longer. There is a definitive social impact to sexual abuse, to child endangerment and trauma. Speaking about our experiences both raises awareness, helps those that have experienced something similar to not feel alone, and may actually serve to change our society for the better. This is an incredibly difficult story for me to share. I get emotional for obvious reasons. Here goes.
Buckle up, and possible trigger warning on this one. I'm going to weigh in on the man versus bear conversation. When I was 12 years old, I ran away from home because I was terrified of my mother's boyfriend. I was scared of him because he leered at me and all my girlfriends, made suggestive remarks, would pin me, tickle me, hold me down, blow darts within an inch of my head, throw knives around me, taunt me on a daily basis. So I lived on the streets for a while. I was only gone from my home for 5 or 6 days. But what I went through on the streets, in a way, paled in comparison to what my imagination provided me if I had stayed home. And I went through a lot in that time. And I'm not getting into that today. I saw some of the worst of humanity and some of the best of it in that short time. And ultimately, after 5 days, I chose to come home. I chose to come home because I felt like I had nowhere else to go. And when I got home with my backpack, I felt like a stranger at my own doorstep. And I knocked on the door because I didn't feel like I could use my key. Okay, I thought I could do this. I'm going to try. My little sister answered the door. I had counseled myself in the time I'd been away, thinking, well, you know, she's young. She hasn't gone through puberty yet. She'll be okay, right? I couldn't take care of her. And I just was crushed with sadness. Now, I'm home for a little bit. I don't know, a matter of days. My mother decides the best thing for us to do is that me and her boyfriend, who had already made a lot of suggestive remarks and who had taunted me for a long time, the best thing for us to do was for the three of us, just me and her and him, to go on a camping trip into the middle of nowhere in Oregon, where there aren't campgrounds, like literally middle of nowhere. I didn't have a choice. You know, I didn't have a choice. So I go with her, and while we're there, I'm confronted with this issue. He is setting up the tent. He wants to sleep in the middle. Because if a bear comes, he wants to be first out of the tent to be able to take down the bear with his Smith & Wesson 357 that's hanging from the tree just outside the tent. And the middle of the tent is going to be the easiest way out. I didn't want to sleep next to him. I asked my mother, could I please sleep next to her? And she said, no, honey. We can't have it happen that way. He needs to be able to get out of the tent. And that night it happened. I woke up to his hands all over my body. My sleeping bag completely unzipped, my nightgown completely up above my breasts. As soon as I opened my eyes, he jerked his hand away and pretended to be sleeping. I got out of the tent. And when my mother woke up, I told her what had happened. She said, I was lying. I was just making something up to ruin her happiness. And then when I insisted, she eventually said, oh, well, maybe he just mistook you for me. I mean, you were sleeping and we were all in the tent together. Right. I looked him in the eye. He knew I saw him and he jerked his hands away. So that night, again, we're there for two nights. He insists on sleeping in the middle. And I tell my mom I'm not sleeping in the tent with him in the middle. And she says, but the bear. And I say, okay. And so I pretend to go asleep. And when he's quiet and everything's quiet in the tent, I get out of the tent. And I get that .357. And I stood at the mouth of the tent with the gun aimed at his head all night long, swearing if he moved, I'd take care of it. So I've made my choice, man or bear. But I even question, if you'd said woman or bear, how I'd feel about it. Because I think when you're alone in the woods, you're safest when you're alone.
Since I posted the clip, so many people have weighed in with their own devastating stories. A resounding theme persists today. There are so many who have been put in harm's way, whose parent or care provider looked the other way, whose experience was not believed. There are also those that think that because most women are choosing the bear, that we are somehow man-hating or person-hating. Some have asked if I hate my mother, which I don't, or if I've gone no contact, which I haven't. But what I have done is remain silent for the 35 years since it all began. And that has ended now. This is the last step, as I see it, of all the many steps to heal from that pain. If you just found this podcast and this episode, I'm fairly certain that you'll also benefit from giving a listen or a watch to one of my earlier episodes in which I interviewed Tim Musso. Tim is also a survivor of sexual assault. He has turned the shaming experience of how he came to understand his trauma into true empowerment. In the episode, he shares that story, and I'll let him do that. Today, he helps people work through trauma, sexual abuse, and assault. He also helps companies create a safer working environment. He often speaks on stages to raise awareness for victims of sexual trauma and assault and help them through their journeys. I hope you'll stick around for this one and that you'll share your thoughts with me after having listened to or watched it. You can reach out to me directly via email to Corinna@caremorebebetter.com. That's Corinna@caremorebebetter.com, or via social channels. You can find me on Instagram as Corinna Belizzi or caremore.bebetter, or on TikTok as Corinna Belizzi, all one word. For now, here's that episode with Tim.
But so often, this is a daily conversation. It's thinking, as I mentioned, that, you know, kind of empathetic curiosity of what do the people around me need? How am I treating them and how am I giving them the opportunity to tell me what that is? And I think the more curious we can be and the more we can bring empathy to that conversation of just thinking about it of here's how I like to be treated. And I know people around me have those same desires. And so let me focus on them and let me focus on really listening to them and hearing them and giving them the time and space to do that. I think if we can get better at that, we can do a much better job at creating, you know, relationships and communities and cultures where people are feeling safe because they know that they're cared for and they know that people care about listening to them.
Welcome to Care More, Be Better, a podcast for people like you who care about the social impact of conscious companies and everyday heroes. Hear inspiring stories from those who put people and planet before profit and personal gain. You'll learn how you can make a difference, vote with your dollars, and get involved today. Here's your host, Karina Bellizzi.
Hello, fellow do-gooders and friends. I'm your host, Karina Bellizzi, an activist and cause marketer who's passionate about social impact and sustainability. So passionate, in fact, that I even created a five-step guide to help you unleash your inner activist. Just go to caremorebebetter.com and sign up for our newsletter. It will be your welcome gift moments later. Today, we're going to talk about a sensitive subject that's got social impact at its core. It may be triggering for some listeners as we discuss what it takes to create a safer society and culture that's free of harassment, sexual violence, and discrimination. To navigate this sometimes difficult conversation, I'm joined by Tim Musso. Tim Musso is a survivor of sexual violence, turned speaker, and advocate on this critical topic. For the past 9 years, Tim has spoken with over 450 organizations, including congressional offices, top universities, and Fortune 1000 companies worldwide. Today, Tim helps organizations move beyond merely meeting compliance standards to instead cultivate empathetic curiosity focused on embracing people's whole selves. Tim Musso, welcome to the show.
Karina, thank you so much for having me and the chance to talk.
Yeah, you know, this is a touchy subject for so many people, myself included. Yeah. Now, I want to make sure I get this right. I looked up some statistics, and the National Sexual Violence Resource Center reports that 81% of women and 43% of men report experiencing some form of sexual harassment or assault in their lifetimes.
Yeah. And the that center is really kind of the best data we have. Essentially, they pull from a variety of sources, including things like the CDC, World Health Organization, Department of Justice. And I think it's much higher than a lot of people anticipate. You know, I think whenever I talk about that number, sometimes I get pushed back and people are like, that's too high. That can be accurate. And the context I always try and provide is, you know, when we talk about sexual violence, it really is that umbrella term. And so it can mean everything from sexual assault or rape to sexual harassment, whether physically or verbally. It can be, you know, someone sending an unsolicited nude photo or video or taking a nude photo or video without permission. It can be online harassment or stalking, in-person stalking, you know, domestic violence or dating violence. And so I think I always try and help people understand that it really does encompass this variety of behaviors, while still making the point that none of them should be occurring and none of them should be happening because every one of them causes harm.
Yeah. Well, it's a huge number. And sadly, a lot of men don't report these types of issues because it's seen as being somehow not manly enough.
Yeah.
So I'd like to first invite you to tell your story and share what made you decide that it was time to come forward and share that with the world.
Absolutely. So my story began for me when I was 22 years old. At the time I was kind of working in my first like real job. I just finished up my master's degree and I started to receive anonymous letters to my place of work. And initially the letters were just very derogatory. They were talking about things that had happened in college, experiences. They were very personally demeaning. And so I kind of knew the person who was sending them knew who I was. And, you know, I had no clue who they were. And then eventually after, you know, about a few months of that, it escalated to the point where I received a letter containing photographs of me actually being sexually assaulted. And so based on the fact that I have tattoos, I know beyond a reasonable doubt that it's me in the photos. And, you know, based on kind of how I look in the photos, I was unconscious and had no memory of this. And up until that moment, I actually didn't have any recollection of what had occurred. And so that was really kind of confronting and dealing with the fact that this had occurred. And, you know, we could tell that it was probably around the ages of 19 to 20. So when I was in college, and that very much changed my world. And, you know, it changed the way I perceived things. It changed the way I looked at relationships. It changed trust with a lot of people because I never found out who did it. And so all of a sudden it called into question all these relationships I had and who it could have been. And then processing it was very difficult. I remember because it was coming to my place of work, I had to tell my, I called the police and I had to tell my then boss what was happening. And his reaction was very derogatory and negative and very shameful. And so that was very harmful for me. And then the police really were not helpful. The way they treated it was almost, again, it was just questions like, well, do you fear for your life? And do you think this person's going to actively hurt you? And then I was essentially told they could do nothing, you know, and I was sitting on top of months of letters and I had these photographs. And so essentially I kind of cut myself off and I just closed myself off to the world. I turned to alcohol as a coping mechanism and I was just angry and isolated. And finally, my mom convinced me just to try and talk to someone because she could see how much harm it was causing to me and she was worried for me. And so I did see a therapist and she got me in connection with a survivor support group of other survivors. And that was really powerful. And as time went on, I kind of started to heal. But then eventually I just had a number of interactions with people where, you know, they would either make derogatory comments or, you know, one of the kind of inciting incidences, I was out with friends and one of the people that I considered a friend at the time made a rape joke. And I remember challenging him on it and him getting defensive and the other two guys we were with getting defensive. And they just didn't care, no matter, you know, what we said or what we talked about. They just were defensive of, well, it's just a joke. It's not a big deal. And so that's when I finally actually publicly came out about my story and kind of started talking about it and started talking about what I went through and the impact I had. And part of it was also, to be honest, retaking some of that control. I knew that the person who had done this to me had used my social media channels and online interactions as a way of kind of showing me, hey, I'm still watching you. I still know who you are. You don't know who I am. And what I figured is, well, if I talk about this and I talk about this openly, no one can hurt me with this information because the person who did this to me has no power over me. And then it allows me to kind of just really start to open up and without feeling that shame because I'm the one controlling what occurred.
Well, I can only imagine what that must have been like. I have to say there are some statistics that I read over that made me question how true they could be. You know, you see something like 40% of men or close to 40% and double that for women. And it's my belief that just being human, we run into some sort of harassment throughout our lives in the ways that you've defined it. Now, the number of people who've actually been what you would call raped is probably much, much smaller than that. But even in my own community, I feel like I'm hard pressed to come across another woman that I'm close with that hasn't been assaulted in some way, like physically assaulted or sexually assaulted, and perhaps not raped, but something that could have led there if they didn't have the right situation where someone was there to protect them, or if they weren't able to escape, or if they had passed out or something along those lines. And there's so much victim blaming and victim shaming that can go on, which you mentioned just now. So how do you see us being able to navigate out of that and getting to a space where the victim can feel more comfortable coming forward and where it's less of a feat of, you know, Herculean will, so to speak?
Yeah. A large part of it, I think, comes down to how we're educating and talking around this topic. I think that to your point of many of those statistics seem so, you know, outstanding and sometimes almost fantastical. I think it's really helping people internalize this is true and this is actually happening. And here's what this looks like. And here's all the ways this can look like, right? Because to your point, I think so many times when people hear those numbers, they just get that defensiveness of this isn't the reality we're facing. And they always want to contextualize in regards to, well, if it's not the worst case scenario, or they always want to, I think, defend some of those behaviors. And I think we have to help people understand the harm that is being caused by any of them and really stop normalizing many of them, right? So like I think about catcalling all the time, because that's certainly included in that 80% number, that 40% number. And a lot of times when I talk with populations, they're like, well, is that as harmful as rape? And I'm like, well, no, I'm not saying necessarily that someone being catcalled is as harmful as, you know, experiencing physical rape, but it's still harm and it still shouldn't be normalized. And why should someone go through that? Why should we violate someone's safety and comfort and autonomy? And why should we make that okay, regardless of the group or organization we're a part of? And so I think sometimes when we can better define how this is looking and what this looks like, we can try and come to a better understanding of all of these are bad and none of these should be normalized and none of these are okay. And we can't accept any of them. We can't make excuses for any of them. And we need to deal with all of them. And then I think from there, it is also talking about what many survivors go through from a trauma-based perspective. I think a lot of times people don't realize how intense it is to be a survivor. They don't realize what it's like to retell your story or to do that. And I think a lot of times we have an over-reliance on the legal system and adjudication processes. And that is certainly part of the picture of changing the way the legal systems handle this, because most legal systems fail. They fail survivors, they fail people who have experiences. And I think that's what adds to that victim blaming narrative of, I think for a lot of people, if you haven't experienced this or you don't know someone who's experienced, that's kind of that responsible. Why not just go to the police? And it's, the answer is, well, because the police do a terrible job at this. Many of them are not trained in how to deal with it sensitively. Situations can be complex and aren't always as cut and dry as we think. And if you do go to the police, you're still probably not going to receive justice. And so I think that in many people's minds, there's this idea of, well, if you experience this, there's a way to deal with it and you should deal with it immediately. And that's discounting the fact that the systems are not actually designed to help you if you experience it. And also, you're probably not processing it, right? Complex trauma, which oftentimes emerges anytime we experience physical violence extremely or intense betrayal or many of these things, it can change the way your brain functions. It changes the way you view the world. And sometimes that takes months or years to process and move through. And this idea of, well, just speak up, is nowhere near as easy as people think. And we have to challenge that, and we have to show them why, and we have to create that kind of sense of empathy, because I think where it lacks, that's where we engage in those behaviors of, well, why didn't they come forward sooner? Or, you know, were they involved in it somehow? Or did they just regret something? And those myths are going to continue when we still lack this empathy for survivors.
Well, and I think there's a lot of disbelief when it comes to somebody coming forward, especially if it's someone that your community knows, right? Like it could be a family member or a close friend in a group. Oh, come on, they're not that way. You must have read the situation wrong or whatever. And all of that kind of prevents people from wanting to speak out, specifically and especially in the cases of date rape. And, you know, there's even situations where we see things like people getting roofied in bars and they wake up the next day and they're not sure what happened and they don't quite remember and everything's a little fuzzy and they're not quite clear on even the circumstances that they were in. As a woman, they might just feel like something is not right. But as a man, you might not even really have some physical kind of leftover feeling to tell you something was up. And so I just think that it's such a sensitive issue, especially when it's gone to the extreme. But even when it's more minor, like even in the workplace, like you might have somebody who's more senior to you or even not senior to you. Maybe everybody in the company looks up to them. And now you're coming forward as a whistleblower to say, you know, they actually acted inappropriately and here's how. So there's fear of retribution. There's fear of what might happen with your job, with your livelihood, especially when we have an economic system that's somewhat uncertain in times of COVID and things like this. Yeah. So I just wonder when you're talking to these corporations, when you're actually going on these tours and speaking to companies about these issues, how are you addressing that?
So with companies, one of the first things is challenging the way we often look at the policies around sexual harassment. Because it's certainly more than policy, but to begin with, most policies fail. For a majority of companies, I think they are relying on the EEOC educational or the EEOC policy around like what this looks like. And so for sexual harassment under that policy, you have to prove legally that it was so severe or frequent that it stopped your ability to do your job. And if that's your baseline policy, the problem becomes it's normalizing all these behaviors that lead up to the point of being so severe or frequent. And this issue becomes that, you know, as we said, any degree of toxicity and harm is toxicity and harm. And so the way I always try and talk with companies about it is it's not enough just to say we don't tolerate any form of sexual harassment, because that oftentimes leaves this gap of your employees are wondering, well, what does that mean? If they Google sexual harassment policies, the first thing's going to pull up is the EEOC policy. And that's telling them frequent or severe. So then in many many sexual harassment survivors' mind, it's, well, this isn't frequent or severe. It was a one-time inappropriate touch or comment or whatever. So I can't report that. So for many companies, the baseline is we need to change the policies. And I think sometimes they're afraid of that, of, well, are we going to hear more reports? Are we going to, you know, have more people come forward? And my response is, Maybe, but don't you want that, right? Like if your people are feeling unsafe and this is occurring in your workplace, don't you want to address that immediately? Like, why do you want to wait until it becomes this really life devastating thing before you deal with it? With that policy change, I also recommend for companies, hey, it's okay to say the way we're going to adjudicate these situations is different. Sure, we know that there's a difference between someone made a comment that was inappropriate and we can try and discern maybe that wasn't their intention versus someone who is abusing their power and making comments that are inappropriate and is trying to do that. The way we're going to handle that is very different, and the resources and tools we're going to provide in those situations can be different. We get that. That's nuance can be applied. From there, it's looking at reporting channels. So what ways do you have it so that employees can come forward, and what are those reporting channels comprised of, and what do they look like? A lot of times I think there's this mindset of, well, we have an open door policy with our managers, and you know, if you have any experiences, come forward and talk to us. And the reaction is, well, if you know you have social dynamics at play, that's not as easy as it sounds. And that policy is nice, but what happens when you are a seasonal employee who's only been there for 3 months and the person who's doing the harassing is a popular full-time employee who's in a position of power and is well-liked, right? And so it's thinking of some of those nuances of how can we overcome that and undercut that. And then the last big piece is, let's try and redefine how we're defining toxicity, how we're challenging toxic behaviors, and when we're intervening and stepping in. Teaching people skills to say, we're not going to let it get to this place. And if someone's going through something, it's not just their responsibility to bring it forward, because that can be very difficult. It's everyone's responsibility to call it out, to address it, to talk about it. One thing I talk about a ton in my work is boundaries, and this idea that every one of us has different boundaries. And it's important to recognize those and to respect those, right? Some people boundaries, we have kind of communal ones. But some people's boundaries might be as simple as, look, like, I don't like talking about my family or dating life at the workplace. Some people say, that's fine with me. I don't care to a point. We can try and accept that, hey, we should do it in a professional way. But it's good to know that, because I think when we can know boundaries much earlier, it gives us an opportunity to respect those before a sense of violation emerges.
Now, you have me thinking about a couple of things here. And one is actually a podcast that I listened to yesterday. And that was one of Tim Ferriss's shows. He interviewed Eric Schmidt, who is the former CEO of Google, helped them rise to the size that they are today, right? And he wrote a book called The Trillion Dollar Coach, which he's currently doing the media tour on, where he features the story of Bill Campbell, and who is considered one of the most valuable coaches of all time, and who did the work that he performed at no cost for leaders of Apple and Google. It's just one example, because he'd already earned all the money he needed to, right? And his personal style involved being quite touchy, like he would hug everybody. And so the reason I bring that up is because I think sometimes we make excuses for people. We say, oh, well, that's just the way they are. They don't mean anything by it. But you can have somebody who, for them, hugging them is crossing a threshold. It could be something that actually is even somewhat traumatic for them, because they just don't like that kind of touch from someone that they're not very close with. And so I wondered how you deal with it when you have that sort of response, when you hear from the people you're talking to, or that you're guiding or coaching or presenting to, oh, well, you know, this boundary seems like it's a little silly to me, or they don't mean anything by it.
Yeah. In my work, I always try and get people to think of their own boundaries first, and try and think about this line of, what does it feel like for you when one of your boundaries is violated? What are the sensations that come up? What are those emotions? How do you respond? How do you react? How would you wish to tell that to the person? How would you like to handle that? Because I think sometimes, to your point, boundaries might seem so niched or nuanced that someone's like, well, you know, this, why do I have to do this? Or they certainly should be able to overcome my, you know, my intentions and understand I'm not doing it from a bad place. And I think sometimes when we can take a step back and focus on what are your boundaries first, and let's talk about what that reaction is. Because I think the other thing I get a lot quite frequently in sessions is, oh, well, I'm not that sensitive. This is coming from, you know, this new culture where you have to be careful of everything and whatever, right? And the thing I always have to challenge them on is, well, that's not true. So let's focus on your boundaries. Because for sometimes when I hear that from audiences, I find their boundaries and we talk about it. And their boundary is, well, I'm uncomfortable with technology because I'm afraid I'm going to be replaced and I'm not used to this, or whatever it might be, right? And so I always try and focus first on that. What are your boundaries and how are those showing up, and how are you asking people to respect them, or what would happen if people don't respect them, and try and think from the perspective of what's maybe a minor boundary and what's a more serious one, to try and create some of that empathy around. We all know what it's like to experience a boundary violation. Every one of us has gone through that at some point in life in some kind of way or capacity. So let's take those feelings and transpose them on someone else. And let's think about what it might feel like for someone else to go through those same things. And then let's recognize that the things we're oftentimes being asked to do is not an intense thing. It's not a really impossible feat. The simplicity of asking someone's boundary is a very quick step. You know, I think that it's, and there's many ways to do it. I think sometimes when we hear boundaries, when we talk about boundaries, there's this idea of, well, you know, it's going to cost so much, or it's going to take me so much to do this. And I think the way I try and challenge it is, like, from this empathetic standpoint, how much better is your program, your culture, your organization, your team going to be if you spend that 5 minutes understanding those boundaries and learning those boundaries? And so for the Bill Campbell example, like, I think, you know, obviously very successful coach, I'm not in a place to challenge him. But the thing I would say to him is, like, imagine how much more comfortable people are going to be as if before you gave a hug, you asked that question. Because as an educator, I know that if I cause someone to check out in one of my sessions, that might be the thing that causes them to have a bad experience the entire time. And that's the last thing I want. And so I think it's trying to create that, like I said, that bridge of empathy for even, you know, someone like Bill, like, hey, I know you're touchy. How much would it suck for you to end a session and have someone approach you and say, I was wanting to pay attention to you. I've heard these amazing things about you, and my day was ruined because you didn't ask me before you gave me a hug. There's a part of you that could get defensive and say, wow, that's awful. But there's another part of you that could take a step back and realize, hey, the solution to this boundary is to simply ask. And then we can start incorporating that, and then we can start bringing that in. And I think that's certainly applicable across organizations, right? It's everything from how do you prefer feedback and communication, to how do we deal with conflict, to do you like to be touched? Are you okay with that? What does that look like? What does that mean? And the more we can know this, the easier it becomes. And I think the other piece about boundaries is knowing that there's going to be times where we negotiate them, right? So I always think with managers, sometimes managers are like, well, I oversee 100 employees and do I have to, you know, all the time, it might be hard. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely, right? If you have an employee that comes to you and says, I prefer to receive feedback in this way, there might be a time where you can't give it to them that way. But if you know that and they know that, at least you can have that conversation beforehand. And all it is maybe an extra line in the email that says, hey, I know you prefer feedback in person. We're on a deadline. We're working from home. I really need to shoot this to you in the email. I'm really sorry. And that shows that other person, they care about me. They respect me. They care about my dignity. They care about my worth. I feel so much better. I trust you more. I feel more engaged with you. I know this is going to change in the future. And I think that kind of stuff is the things that really matter. And it's the reason people stay. It's the reason people engage. It's the reason people care, because it's that simple act of your boundaries are not about me. They're about you. But that's where that empathy comes in.
Well, I think those are all good points. One thing I will say is part of what has got me thinking more about this is that I'm a rather touchy-feely person. Like, I like to give handshakes and hugs. But in this time of COVID, we don't do that the same way as much anymore. It feels like a rarity, and I've missed it. But I've heard the reverse response from some of the people I'm connected to. Like, gosh, this COVID thing is actually really nice. I don't have people invading my space anymore. And it always felt like I was being kind of crowded out or made to feel smaller by close talkers or by people who would kind of invade my personal space. And they really do see it as an invasion. It's not something that they enjoy. And so it does make them feel smaller or disrespected. And so even just thinking about that a little bit differently in today's world and in the climate that we're in, I think is helpful, because it shows people that you actually care about their experience and their perspective. So I'm just, as a close talker myself, or as someone who enjoys hugging, what would be the advice you would give that person as they confront somebody who maybe is a little bit more introverted and doesn't enjoy that kind of close proximal experience as much?
Yeah, I think one of the best things you can do is always ask. Right. And I know that sounds simple, and it kind of is, but we also have to factor in power dynamics. We have to think about some of those type of things. We have to be aware of that. So thinking about when you're asking, where you're asking, what the situation looks like, how much time in advance do you have? You know, the thing I always try and mention is, if I ask you a question, I have essentially forced you into a response, right? If I ask you a question right now, you have to have some kind of response. You can't just, you know, I mean, you could hang up the right the interview and be done, but like, that's still a response. And so I think we have to be very aware of that when we're in a situation, right? So for that idea of like, I like to hug people. If you are in someone's face, 2 feet from hugging them, and you're like, can I hug you? And your arms are already outstretched. Someone might feel discomfort saying no, because you have made your intentions already clear that you want to hug them, versus when you see them, you're across the room. That might be a little different. I think the language you use is very powerful as well. One thing I always recommend people avoid is the term, are you okay with? When I ask the question, are you okay with, I have kind of subconsciously prompted you the answer I want to hear. By putting in the feeling in the question, I'm kind of telling you, I want you to be okay with this, versus how do you feel about? Because how do you feel about gives you the power to define your own emotion, right? So are you okay with tells you, kind of want you to be okay, versus how do you feel is, well, you provide me the emotional idea. You know, you provide me your comfort level. You provide me in those some of those areas. And I think other times it's really good just to model our boundaries. So to show people it's okay and that we know what we're doing. I know I've used the term boundaries a lot, and obviously it doesn't have to be that, right? If you meet someone or you're seeing them for the first time after a long time away because of COVID, you don't need to be like, hey, my boundary is this. It's, hey, I prefer right now to stay distant from people because of health concerns. Is there anything, you know, that you prefer, or is there any desires that you have in regards to physical touch or things like that, right? And so sometimes by sharing that boundary and modeling the way of giving them your boundary, it gives them the opportunity to provide boundaries as well.
Well, I'm smiling because I was recently at She Podcast Live in Arizona for an event. And they actually had color-coded lanyards to help communicate that. You wore a red lanyard if you were wanting to remain socially distant from people and more concerned with COVID or for any reason. You wore a yellow one if you were okay in certain situations, and a green one if you were basically the extrovert hugger, right? Yeah. And so there was a color coding, which I thought was just novel and kind of genius.
Yeah. Yeah, I always appreciate when organizations take those steps, because I think so much of this has to be on the organization, right? On a systemic level, whether it's violence prevention, harassment prevention, talking about creating safe cultures, I always try and really help organizations realize this is your job. I think so many trainings and seminars around violence prevention and around harassment, all these things, it really focuses on like, let's teach our employees individual skills that they can deploy. And my reaction is, I mean, sure, but if you're not creating an environment and a culture and the systems in place to change this, then this is really something that's going to lack, right? I just finished up a series of studies, and I interviewed 83 managers and 379 of their direct employees. And the questions were around boundaries and what does that look like and how are we setting them and does our organization offer tools for these? And what I found time and time again is that managers consistently had a more profound view of how boundaries were being discussed, shared, talked about, and you know, negotiated within their organization than their employees did. And managers oftentimes have this perception that, yeah, we're talking about it. My employees are comfortable sharing this with me. We give them tools to do this. And an overwhelming majority of the responses from employees were, no, we don't feel like we know how to talk about this. Even more so, it was like, we feel comfortable sharing this with our peers, but not our leaders, because we're afraid they're going to use it against us in compensation, employment, whatever it is. And I think there's that gap and disconnect between, you know, sometimes when we look at the organizational level of, if you are running the company, if you're running the organization, if you're running the event, you should think about these things, right? Because I think about that, you know, podcast convention you were at, it would have been easy for them to say, hey, it's the time of COVID, every attendee, make sure to tell each other what comfort level you have with physical contact. While someone's introverted, they may be new to the community, they don't have as much power, it's the star podcaster who everyone just saw speak on stage that comes up to you, saying no is hard, right? Versus, hey, we're gonna actually just give you a tool. We're gonna know that this is an important boundary we have, so we're going to bring this into the lanyard system. So it's already there, it's taken care of. We're going to give you this language to use and this tool to define this, so you don't have to worry about doing that as much.
Well, I appreciated that too. So, I mean, I wore a green lanyard, and when I saw another one, I was like, are we going to hug? So question for you, as we bring this into the personal space and professional at the same time, which relates to dating, because I think that now a lot of companies have gotten very restrictive on what they'll allow. Like, you have to sign a waiver if you're going to date somebody in your community. And a lot of people, like, heck, they spend a majority of their lives at work while they're awake, and they get to meet people at work. They get to know people at work. They become attracted and intimate. And there's this kind of navigation that we all kind of have to walk through in that space. Now, I personally shied from dating anyone I worked with for this very reason, because it was just, well, what do you do? And what if it doesn't work out? And. But that's not always an option for people. So how do you advise people who are, you know, going into that dating realm and also considering this issue of consent?
Yeah, in dating in the workplace is certainly complex, right? Because like you said, there's the policy side, which, you know, there's that. And anytime we talk about consent, there's kind of this legal side. And then there's the human nature side, where sometimes people say, well, policy be damned. This is what I, you know, I feel for this person. My emotions are there. They feel for me. And so this is what we're going to do. I think that's why, from an organizational perspective, you should make sure that your policies are clearly communicated, and they're also very relevant and tangible and actually enforceable. And they're really realistic to what's going on, right? I think sometimes hard no in any policy is going to fail, right? I think a majority of times we know that it's kind of like that can oftentimes fail. But I think it's like thinking about how big is the company? What's your role in relation to that other person? What does that look like? Who needs to know? How is this going to impact your jobs? Have you had that conversation about how this is going to impact your jobs? Have you sought out feedback in some of those areas? And are you willing to kind of accept the end result of what might happen? Right? Because I think sometimes it's easy to say, well, I just care for this person and I want to be with them. But you should be having that conversation with that potential partner of, here's a potential repercussion. Like, if our company says no, and they find out about this, we could both lose our jobs. Are we ready for that? And if we are ready for that, are we aware that this might completely change our relationship? Because now we're no longer seeing each other, we have to find a new job in a tough economy. And all of a sudden, this is out the window. Or it might be, hey, our company policy is that this is okay, but they might move us into different roles. Again, are you ready for that response? Are you ready for what that looks like? Have you talked about that with your potential partner? Are you having that honest conversation? I think sometimes it's also good to, when you're looking at workplace dating, talk a little bit more about the long term early. And I know that might be frightening to people of like, oh, we don't want to rush into things. And I'm like, yeah, but the dynamics are different, right? If you just meet someone at a coffee shop and you go on dates with them, you might have a little more leeway, versus if you're working together and you've known each other for a while, you have to think about, how is this going to impact power dynamics? What are the existing power dynamics? How is this going to impact promotion and, you know, employment and all those kind of things, right? Because it's that difference of, well, we really like each other now, but we're the same level, right? And we're in the same job. Well, what happens when you don't disclose to the organization that you're dating, and all of a sudden it comes time for promotion and there's three candidates and both of you were, you know, two of those, and they have to promote one of you and they pick one partner over the other, right? Like, have you thought about that? Have you had that conversation? Have you talked about it? Have you primed yourself for what that looks like? Are you willing and ready to do that? And I know some of that seems like, well, I don't know. And that's okay. I think that might be an honest conversation you can have of, I'm not sure, and I'm not really up to date on what this looks like, because I haven't experienced this yet. And then I think the other thing is thinking about, you know, what are your coworkers' boundaries? What are your boundaries as a couple? And how can you really be respectful of both of those? So again, if you're in a company that has a very no tolerance dating policy, the heart wants what the heart wants, you decide to date a coworker, so you feel like you can't disclose to anybody, understand that. How are you then making sure that you're going to protect each other and protect your peers and employees and coworkers and everyone? You know, if you're in a situation where it is okay to date, but you still have to figure that out, it's those boundaries, right? And being very clear about them with your partner. And like I said, with your peers, because I think especially with your partner, because things are going to come up of like, well, what about PDA? And what about conflict? And what about communication? And what about how we give each other feedback? And all of those kind of pieces have to be answered. So I think there just needs to be a little bit of a pause and really discerning, what are we getting into? And have we talked about that? And are we ready for both the repercussions as well as some of the challenges that come from it?
Well, I've seen it work out, as I think many people have. I've also seen it go bad and end in people feeling like they were somehow, they lost opportunity because of the relationship or something else. So, you know, it's just a tough situation, I think. What can you say? Sex is complicated.
Yeah, right. Across the board, it's, I think we always want to make it a kind of, you know, clear cut situation of, if this happens, this happens, if this happens, this happens. And it's so hard and it's so difficult to know those things and to really figure it out, because relationships, You know, whenever I teach consent, I always talk about like we're dealing with another human being who has histories and identities and complexities and desires and wants and really this multitude. And that's never going to be simple, regardless of the extent of the relationship. It's always going to be difficult.
So what sorts of resources do you direct people to when they have questions around these things like consent? Because I'm coming from a perspective here of a mom of two boys, right? I've got a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old, and I've already had to have the consent conversation with each of them, just as it relates to body autonomy and things like that. But I want to set them up for success long term. And that may even mean, you know, hey, asking questions like, is it okay if I hug you and things like that. So what would you advise or what resources would you put out there for me and my community?
Yeah. So I think there's, you know, I don't necessarily always do a ton of work within kind of high schools and younger age students, but I think like, I know it's the Boston Public School System and Boston Health Commission. I want to say it's called the Start Strong program. Mm-hmm. And they have either Start Strong or Strong Foundations. They have a wealth of resources that I know have been both done within the Boston Public School System, as well as some of them are online, or at least the foundations of those resources are online. And a lot of it focuses on some of those kind of pieces of, hey, here's how you talk about consent. And here's when you can start talking about it, right? Here's, you know, bodily autonomy. You can introduce that to a 3-year-old. If you don't want to hug someone, you don't have to hug someone. You don't have to touch someone that you don't, right? Things like that. You know, this is yours and that's only yours. And I know that there's a lot of that curriculum that exists out there of here's how you talk about it at different ages. Here's how you introduce these ideas. Even I know one really revolutionary thing that they've done is they've talked a lot about kind of like media and porn literacy. So if you're, you know, in your teenage years, we know sometimes the average age that children nowadays are accessing pornography is anywhere from 9 to 12. And so it's like, how do you have conversations around what that looks like and understanding what you're seeing and what's happening in those kind of films and understanding the difference between those and reality and all of that kind of piece, right? And so I think some of those systems exist. I know with college students, it's always trying to offer tools. There's a number of nonprofits I always point to, the Joyful Heart Foundation, One in Six, RAIN, which is a national survivor support network. Many of those have resources and tools for many college students or college age students. I know Your Title IX is another tool that focuses on kind of campus-based policy for both community colleges and colleges, really just focus on what that adjudication looks like and rights and privileges, you know, when you're there dealing with sexual violence. And then I think when you start to look a little older, I think for companies, right, a good resource I recommend is a company called EverFi. They do a lot of research that I always respect and appreciate because they're talking a lot about what it means to build safe cultures. And I think they try and take a more proactive stance on harassment prevention. I also know Gallup does a lot of surveys and polling about like, what are our perceptions around these issues? What does this mean? How is this impacting us? What does that look like, right? The other thing I would say for just purely kind of consent and sexual violence, focus a little bit on colleges, but I think it's really illuminating, is a book called Sexual Citizens that came out of research that was done at Columbia, I think either Columbia, yeah, I want to say Columbia, by two researchers who did a kind of longitudinal study that really pulled from a lot of dialogues with how people were perceiving sexual violence, their reactions to it, what it looked like, many of those pieces.
Great. Well, I will be sure to include links and show notes so people have resources to go to. As we prepare to wrap up, I wonder if there's any question that I haven't asked that you wish I had. And if there is, please ask and answer.
I think a good question to think about is, how do you support someone if they come forward and tell you that they've experienced a form of sexual violence or harassment? Because I think that's a huge thing that a lot of people have questions about. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, we're not trained on it. We don't talk about it. We're not always aware of it. And so I think that's kind of a really good area we could talk about. I think, you know, whenever you're dealing with supporting someone who's experienced any form of sexual violence, right? So assault, rape, harassment, whatever it is, I would say there's kind of the reaction of if it just occurred in the immediate versus if you're dealing with it after the fact. So if an incident of violence just occurred in the immediate, you want to make sure to get that person away to a safe space, away from where the incident occurred, remove them from the situation. If physical violence was involved, you can recommend that they get medical attention. The key word I always say is recommend, because generally when you experience sexual violence, it's a loss of power and control. And so you don't want to force them to do anything else because that's further taking away power and control. So you, if there was physical violence, you can recommend medical attention, help them find those resources and services, let them know what that process might be look like, offer to go with them. But ultimately, it's their choice. You can recommend they document, right? So that's another recommendation is if you want to take some kind of documentation around this, if that's possible, even, you know, being very careful of you're not guiding that process. Because I think sometimes we might ask questions that we feel are being helpful or trying to, you know, keep information. It can be very hard and traumatic for that person to talk about it in that moment. So kind of just helping them think about if you do want to document this, know that you don't have to press charges. You don't have to use any legal resources. You don't have to go through an organizational channel. But if you choose to in the future, it might help. So just prompting them, you know, think about the details of the event or what happened and write that down as much as you're comfortable with. Yeah.
I have a question that relates to this because it has to do with rape kits and backlogs.
Yep.
I've actually had people say to me, well, what's the point of getting the rape kit if they've got a 5-year backlog in my local municipality or something to that effect? So what would you say to that person in that case? And do you know if there's a way to speed something forward if they are interested in pursuing action?
So it depends on if they choose to go to the police and advance the case, right? So that's one of the things that can potentially move it forward at a faster rate, depending on the evidence that is deemed from the police, the evidence they provide. If it actually is moving forward in that kind of process, generally it might be fast-tracked a little. Sometimes the other thing is helping people understand this is you can still get a rape kit done and you don't have to press charges. With storage now, it's much better and it tends to last longer. So it can be helpful if you choose to eventually press charges. And that's the thing I oftentimes tell survivors of physical violence in the moment. Just know that it's your legal right that if you go to a hospital and you get a rape kit done, the hospital may call the police, but you don't have to press charges in that moment. That is your right. That's your prerogative. So that's something that's for you. It's just that idea of you don't have to make that decision now. If you choose to in the future, that might help. And it just might help with the documentation of things, the collection of evidence, all of those kind of pieces. And so just understanding some of that kind of work that's going on there, because I certainly hear that. And I know that there's horrifying stories out there about communities that have mismanaged their rape kits. They have not stored them properly. And so, you know, decades of DNA evidence was lost. And that's where I understand, you know, I always talk about the legal resources, but I understand why so many survivors choose not to use them and to pursue them.
And there's also cases where they end up being incredibly useful in finding serial rapists. So, you know, the DNA is out there. And when they do get to it, it can result in catching a violent criminal who would otherwise have gotten off, so to speak.
Yeah, the system is broken, but it works occasionally. And it can work. And it can, like I said, it can provide benefit in both your own case or to other individuals as well. And then, you know, I think if you're dealing with an incident that occurred in the past, if someone is telling you about something that happened a few days ago, weeks ago, months ago, years ago, I think that idea of creating that safe environment for them is good. Sometimes just saying, hey, look, I appreciate you sharing this with me. Thank you. I'm so sorry this happened. I appreciate you trusting me. But really just saying, you know, is this the best place to talk? Is there someone else that's somewhere else that's better for you? Do you feel safe and comfortable here? I think really just focusing on the powerful question of how can I help you and what do you need from me at this moment? It's not our job to fix someone else. And that's rarely what they're asking for. And the last thing we need to do is try and, you know, provide them resources or tools or, you know, support that they're not needing. You know, I work with a lot of survivors and sometimes they want resources. Sometimes they just want to tell their story. Sometimes they just want to talk about something or they do want to ask a question. And that's why I always think that phrasing of how can I help you and what do you need from this conversation or what do you need from me are really great places to ground it because everyone's going to need something different and it really focuses on them. As I mentioned, being very careful of the questions you're asking. You do not want to re-traumatize them or ask a question that goes too far. And then if they ask for resources, figuring out what those resources look like, how involved you can be in that process, what help they need there. And then one of the last things I say is always try and set some boundaries of what does this look like going forward? Because sometimes people may tell you something and they want to talk about it in the future. Other times they might just tell you something and that's it. And so I think that question of like, well, what do you need from me moving forward as well is helpful because you want to be clear about someone might say, I don't ever want to talk about this again. Great. So that's a good thing to know. If you're worried about their behaviors, changes in behavior, things like that, you might try and figure out a way to bring it up to them. But otherwise, it's trying to focus on what do they need and, you know, setting that boundary. So you know, hey, yeah, bring this up to me, but be very careful about who you bring it up in front of. Hey, I prefer you not to text me about this because who knows who might see my phone. Hey, you know, I only want to talk about this in person. Just some of that information can be really good. And then watch out for people in the long term, right? In both scenarios, as I mentioned, if you see changes in behavior, try and be honest about it. You never want to assign intentions to someone of saying, I think you're doing this because you went through this, but just saying, hey, I noticed this and I'm, you know, I was wondering what might be going on or is there help I can provide?
Great. Well, I want to offer you the opportunity to sum up what you'd like our audience to leave this conversation with today. I imagine it'll be something about boundaries since we've talked so much about that. But really, you have the floor.
This is preventing sexual violence and harassment and creating safe cultures is really, I think, a lot of times much smaller than we think. Yes, the egregious behaviors, we need to call them out. We need to stop them. We need to prevent them from occurring. But so often this is a daily conversation. It's thinking, as I mentioned, that, you know, kind of empathetic curiosity of what do the people around me need? How am I treating them? And how am I giving them the opportunity to tell me what that is? And I think the more curious we can be and the more we can bring empathy to that conversation of just thinking about it of here's how I like to be treated. And I know people around me have those same desires. And so let me focus on them and let me focus on really listening to them and hearing them and giving them the time and space to do that. I think if we can get better at that, we can do a much better job at creating, you know, relationships and communities and cultures where people are feeling safe because they know that they're cared for and they know that people care about listening to them.
That's great. Thank you so much, Tim. Now, where can people go to find you? And again, I'll be sure to include this in show notes.
The best place is my website. So timmusso.com, just my first and my last name. I have all my kind of contact information on there. I publish blogs, research, all that kind of stuff there as well. So,
yeah, I've seen some speaking engagements there and some quick resources and even some YouTube videos that you've created. So that's really great. Well, thank you so much. This has been a joy. Even as difficult as the subject is for me, as I imagine it is for many listening too, I really believe that you've helped to boil it down to the core essentials to really support the journey of people in the workplace and in their personal life as well. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. Thank you again, Karina, for the time and the ability to talk about this.
Great. I'd love it if you would also share this episode and our website, caremorebebetter.com, with your friends. Subscribe to this podcast. You can even do that for them. Just download an episode or two and grab their phone and click subscribe. Now, it's through discussions like this, these in-depth conversations that we have with people like Tim Musso, that we can create a more caring community around the globe. We can grow. We can even resolve trauma. We can even resolve trauma. Thank you, listeners, now and always, for being a part of this pod and this community, because together we really can do so much more. We can care more. We can be better. We can even create a safer society and regenerate Earth. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Care More, Be Better, a podcast for social good. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And share with your friends to help us reach more people and spread more social good.